Welcome to Medicast. I'm Josh Anderson.
And I'm Bob Galen. Welcome, Medicasters, to another fine early morning in Cary, North Carolina.
Yes, it is. So, our topic today is managers, manager anti-patterns and beyond. One of the things that we wanted to talk about was some common things you might see, hopefully not at your place of work, but maybe at a friend's place of work, and how you can help them deal with some potential issues.
So this morning, I guess we're going to pick, so we don't often do it, we sort of indirectly do it, maybe directly every once in a while, but we're going to hit them.
We are on attack.
This morning, just through this morning, I think, maybe beyond, for bad management. Is it just going to be Agile only, Josh?
Or no.
Now, we'll lean towards Agile-centric patterns, but we're going to hit all of them.
Yep.
Are we?
Yep.
Bad traditional management patterns. So yep. Pointy-headed manager pattern.
You can be a bad manager regardless of methodology.
regardless of nation, of age, of nation,
yes.
you can be terrible in
you
many
can
ways.
Mess it up.
In any language.
In it, yeah. You name it, you can
right.
do it.
Yeah. Where do we, you want to start, want to kick us off?
Yeah, so the place.
Oh, hold it. We need a disclaimer. Because you and I are working.
Yes.
So why don't I add this disclaimer?
Okay.
So none of our references are to any named managers we have at the moment.
That is correct.
Even if it sounds, even my boss, if you're listening out there, or Josh's boss, or bosses, if you're listening out there, none of these examples have anything to do with you. You all are wonderful.
This is only a commentary on our past lives.
Yes, and what we've observed in the wild.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So it has no. We are protecting the names to protect. You know, hiding the names to protect the innocent or the guilty.
Yes.
Cool.
Okay.
Let's go. Jump in, dude.
Do you think that's going to save us?
No. No. But it was a try. It was a try.
All right. So I figured I'd kick it off with the big topic from our very first Medicast way back over a year ago, being trust, where we talked about being a leader. And so one of the key things that we saw recently at a talk we gave was a manager's inability to become comfortable with building an Agile team because there was no trust there, and being unable to enable the team to become self-directed. And it was like, what are they going to do? If I don't tell them what to do, how are they going to know what to do? If there's like 5 minutes extra in this sprint, what are they going to do if I don't have it lined up? So that's kind of where I want to start. So Bob, have you seen anything, do you have any story that really drives that home?
I think traditional management, software management, is not built on trust. It's built on control. So that's the root of the problem. So you and I did a co-talk. And this example hit both of us. We were talking about this before we turned on the Medicast this morning. And it just reminded me of how extreme traditional management is from a dysfunction, from a trust point of view. So now you don't say it. That's the insidious part. You know, so 20 years ago or 25 years ago, I didn't put I don't trust you like I have an I don't trust you button on my. It would have been better if I would have done that, right?
Right.
At least I would have been more honest and more congruent. And I wasn't malicious. I mean, but I really grew up in the command and control world, which said, you know, my role was to line up the ducks.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Nobody does it trying to be mean. They're doing it trying to protect themselves and the project. And a lot of times it's the only way they know how.
It's the only way they know how to sort of drive it is, and it's really an unfortunate pattern because, yes, they don't trust the team. You're absolutely right. But they think that their sole role is sort of what the champion. They put all the weight on their shoulders to what? To drive project success,
right.
And to drive everyone in the right direction. And what they're trying to do is to be everywhere at every time, looking over people's shoulder. You didn't write that line of code right. Could you rewrite it? Oh, we need additional tests. And they're not activating the team. And that's a very traditional style. And you know what? Employees acquiesce to that. They get comfortable with that.
Right.
So forget the pointy-headed managers are distrustful. But you know what? Employees just sort of, you know, hunker back in their cocoons.
And, and there's no risk, right? It's like if the project fails, it's not my fault.
You
fire the boss.
You look up.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen eyes roll upward.
Right.
Right. And everyone sort of blames the boss. Now, the entire team was they were a team, no matter how much command and control there was. So there was accountability. They were refuting that. They were kicking it upstairs. So I think that's one of the underlying problems in sort of traditional management, is that general lack of trust.
Right.
And I think you hit the. I heard it yesterday, and I think you heard it as well.
Yep. Pause for dog.
So I think again, it's a traditional view of folks, managers looking to the team like I lead you. And you don't add value, and bringing it back. So that's the anti-pattern, and I see that anti-pattern in a lot of ways. You see it even in agile teams now where, so there's global trust, there's sort of the global, you know, are you following the project plan? And let me monitor the project plan, and let me tell you what to do. And part of that trust is you said it was going to be 2 days, and it's a day and a half, or it's late. It's late now. What are you going to do to make it up and things? So it's very dictatorial. But then there's the softer distrust. There's people that act like they, you know, they trust the team sometimes. So I'll punt this to you. But have you seen it where, you know, someone in an agile, it's like half-baked agile trust? So you have managers who have the facade of, oh, yeah, I trust the self-directed team, but then their behaviors don't really support that, so they hover too much. Have you ever seen any of that stuff?
Yeah, that's hard a lot of times, and you get that when there's a transition and people are trying to transition to agile, and the managers, and it's a difficult thing to change to, but chickens not being chickens, you know, and jumping and reacting too quickly instead of taking on that coaching role and guiding and jumping on a team during a stand-up because the burn down's not updated or it's not where it needs to be, and you need to jump on them, but continuing to jump on them where they end up relying on the manager again. So they end up coming full circle where the manager begins driving the agile process, and it all comes back to, again, the eyes look upward of, okay, so our burn down's not where it needs to be, and everybody turns and looks at the manager like, what should we do? So via repetitive reminding of the team or slapping the team or whatever happens, the team falls right back into the old mode of, okay, well, what are you going to tell me what to do? I don't know where to go here. I ran out of tasks, so I'm just going to sit and wait.
Right. I see that a lot in agile teams where, you know, it's a transitional, to your point. It's transitional in the leadership. So I look at it as like sort of an assessment. I did an assessment a couple of weeks ago of a team, and there was a sort of dysfunction going on in the team. And I think there was a team-based view to it. The team was part of it. There was a dance going on in the team. But I think leadership probably initiated some of it. So they were agile. They were going whole hog agile. They'd read the books, et cetera, et cetera. But their behaviors weren't, you know, their behaviors weren't lining up. And the team was really just hunkering down. So it was actually creating a chasm between them because the managers were misbehaving, but they thought they didn't know they were.
Right.
The team was staying entrenched, and in an agile context, it sort of widened it, and there was a lot. There's actually a lot of tension between the two groups.
Right.
Almost to the point of, you know, like corrective actions, like they were, you know, maybe firing people and things. It wasn't quite there at all, but it was. But I could see that path coming in, and folks weren't opening their eyes. So I think trust is one of those sort of basic things that you just don't trust the team. I would agree with you. What else have you seen?
I think there's a couple things of trust. There's where it comes into play. It's not trusting estimates, and I've seen this a lot where the team says it's 12, and it rolls upstream, and they say, "Well, that can't be 12." And I say, "Well, how do you know better than the people that are actually writing and testing the code? How do you know that better? How can you estimate it better?" Like, well, because I'm the manager. I know everything, you know, and I don't see how that's physically possible.
See, I don't even think it. So what I saw, I'm slightly older than you. I use that line every once in a while. Just barely older than you. I actually go back to the days where there was this weird dance between managers, and I was stuck in it. So I danced the dance where they didn't believe me, Josh. It wasn't like subtle, they know better. Forget that. They thought I was lying. So they flat out said, he's sandbagging me.
Right.
So their job was, so there was this weird dance between these damn software teams are sandbagging us. So what I got to do as a manager is my job is to put as much pressure on these guys to squeeze the grease out of them,
right.
To squeeze the padding out. And they would insanely put pressure on you. And if you sat down with them over a beer or something like that, just every once in a while, it would come out. It wasn't, they just didn't believe you. So right. What is that? I guess that's ultimate a distrust factor.
Right.
But they thought I was lying. They wouldn't use the word, but it was flat out, you're lying to me.
Right.
And, you inflated everything by, and they use these mental terms, Josh, of like, and it didn't even matter. It could be a complex project or a simple project. It didn't freaking matter. It was, you're padding by at least a third, so I need to get a half out of you,
right.
Out of your hide, right? And that's because I want you to stretch.
Right.
So if you're lying by a third, I got to take a half away. And then we're in the ballpark, and they didn't give a rat about like the project itself. It
right.
was all the game,
yeah.
And it was all based on just like this lying factor.
And it's amazing how if that's how people were managed and they become managers, that's how they manage.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a generational thing where whoever your manager was, especially when you first came in the game, right, and that's how you were raised. That's how you end up being a manager.
Well, you see that happen in families, right? They talk about abusive, and I'm not, but there's this abusiveness factor that carries, even though you have recognition that it's a bad behavior because you didn't like it.
Right.
You have the habit. The habit continues in families, and I think that you bring up a really good point of, and I think Agile, because everyone on the Metacast knows that we love Agile. We got to bring it back there every once in a while. But I think Agile tries to break that vicious cycle, but it's a vicious breakage, so it's very uncomfortable.
Right.
When an Agile adoption for managers of this stripe is incredibly uncomfortable for
yep.
you, right?
Yep.
Because it's challenging you. It's not challenging a skill. It's challenging you to the core of what you believe in your behaviors.
Right. So I'm guessing when they set about to create the Agile Manifesto that they had been through some of these things and said, all right, enough is enough. How are we going to change the game to where this isn't the way things happen? And I think I'm pretty darn sure it's one of the driving factors that led those folks to get in the room and say, all right, we're going to fix this somehow, some way.
Well, the estimation game is one of those, and it's not just that. It's at the end. So part of that estimation game that I talked about was coming back at the end and then just threatening everyone, right?
Right.
Because it's you committed. Oh, gosh, I hated that. You committed. So you gave me an estimate, and people would do the best they possibly could. Leadership thinks you're lying, so they put you're padding by a third. And there was padding in there. So right. Trust me, there
yeah,
was.
Yeah, because
there
you
was,
had to pad to defend yourself. To defend.
So
yeah.
It's this weird. But there was padding in there. Yeah. Well, there was. But there was this weird game. The pressure would go on. And then once they got a commitment, I remember once the CEO of a company I was working for, he sat me in a chair, Josh, and he wouldn't let me leave his office. I felt like I was being interrogated by, like Middle East, the
yeah.
Iranians or something like that. So, it's like doing waterboarding. So, but he was giving me drinks. So he's giving me Cokes and we were talking, but he kept like, good, take a drink. Can you do it? Can you do it in 2 weeks? And he just
did it until you cracked.
He just badgered, and I was weak, Josh. And I know. I was.
It was a young Bob, though.
I was young and I was weak. I'm sorry, Josh. And I freaking crumbled.
Yeah.
And guess what happened? So this comes into maybe another pointy-headed manager. Guess where he went the next freaking day?
I don't know.
Did he care? So were we talking about the project any longer, Josh?
No.
No. When did he come back?
2 weeks.
No. Well, 2 weeks or whatever. It was like a month. It was like a 6 month project or something like that. He came back like a week before the end of the project. Hey, Bob, I'm here now again. So he went away. He literally went away. So there was this. There's another part of this thing is this lack of engagement. How can you be a leader?
Mm-hmm.
For a project, and this was a crucial project for us. The projects we did, this was at a trading systems company. So I can talk about Hank. I don't even know if Hank's alive anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He may not be with us anymore. But Hank had spent 30 years at IBM, and this is indicative of this is traditional style. And Hank just beat the crap out of people. He just pushed you to death. He didn't, and then he looked for results. And then Hank would come back at the end, and then heads would roll. Right. So he'd be looking for who can I fire? So either you're successful or I'm going to, like, you know, heads are going to roll or something's going to happen. And we were taking on business. Every one of our contracts had penalty clauses. So he should never have left. He should have been engaged with us along mm-hmm. the way. So we were negotiating with our real customers. We were doing trading systems. But Hank went away. So there's that general view of my work here is done. So my that traditional view is I get involved in the beginning, and I come back at the end for the surprise.
Right.
And I think that's BS.
Right. And so that's our, we can go on there. That's our next one is disengagement, if that's even a word.
It is. If it's not a word, it should be a word.
All right. Good. So, we will coin it. I'll call Webster tomorrow.
Exactly.
So disengagement, and you gave a great example of what that means, of the manager's there for the kickoff and everybody's excited and go team go, and then they don't do anything and expect it to be magic at the end. And like you said, managed by fear, you know, everybody's worried, okay, if we don't make this, you know, we're going to lose our jobs and so on and so forth. And the end comes and they come and do the final checkup. Okay, is everything done to get that big check mark
exactly.
on that board?
Exactly.
And if not, they're like, well, what? How did this happen? You know, I built the perfect plan.
Not on my watch.
Yeah, exactly.
This can't happen on my watch. Your watch was on the golf course, you moron. Right? what are you talking about? You had no watch.
Exactly.
It's, I mean, I think disengaged. And there's a myriad of excuses for that, right? So Hank was probably an extreme example. And I'm not, this is truth. This mm-hmm. is a true story. So this was Hank, and Hank dealt with projects this way all the time. So he didn't leave to play golf. He left to put pressure on yet another project to drive it. So he would be managing multiple, we were a larger company. So that was his view of managing. But I think if you bring it down to the microcosm, there are folks, project managers, they're only there to get status. They're not there to help. What is that view of? Don't bring me problems without a connected solution.
Right.
To me, that's sort of BS. I understand it, but what you're saying is don't ask me to help you.
Right.
Right. Help yourself. Well, yes. In some cases, you should help yourself.
Right.
But not in all cases. Engagement.
Right.
Right. Disengagement. I think good agile leaders are engaged. I mean, I'm looking for, even if I don't like the answer, and I think and hope you're doing the same thing, if something pops up, if five things pop up every day, and all five of them are really painful for me, and I don't like them, and I don't appreciate them, but I handle them because I'm engaged for my team.
Yeah,
right?
And that's one of the real beauties of having the number of teams that I do, the transparency that Agile provides is, even when I'm spread a bit thin via the tools, I can do a quick check with our tools and see, okay, how are things going? And if I have questions, then I ask the right questions.
Yeah.
But I don't need to badger them. I don't need to hover. I don't need to do anything. And would I prefer to be able to check in daily with each team and, you know, be at the stand-up, be at every stand-up, and to kind of get that pulse and see how things are going? Absolutely, right? But stuff happens, and I can't always be there. But Agile really enables me to get that quick pulse without having to dig into a project plan that's 855 pages long and trying to look at a Gantt chart that's three times even longer and trying to figure out where everybody is and where we should be and how much are we off and can we get back on track and all those things.
Well, even that level of granularity, now that you bring it up, is probably the wrong level of granularity. I mean, by the time you figure out that Sally is an hour and a half off, something has moved in that, right? So you're managing. That's another thing that I think pointy-headed managers do. When they do get engaged, at those occasions when they get engaged, they're non-helpful because they're looking at the micro stuff. They're trying to have micro decisions that really the team should be handling. Would
right.
you buy that?
Yeah, at my last job, Friday afternoon, which should be kind of one of the happier times in a worker's life.
I think so.
You know, was the worst 3+ hours of my week. Because every day, I'd have to go in my boss's room and we would look at the project plan.
Ugh.
And we would say, where's everybody at? And we would manage it down to the hour level.
Right.
And I would have to answer questions of why is this here? What are we going to do? How are we going to adjust it? And so we got through that pretty easy, right? We got through that in the first hour. the next 2 hours were readjusting the project plan and trying to automagically balance these 10 people and the resources and get it all to fit in this magic date. And that was, I simply dreaded
every week.
Every week.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Friday afternoons were horrible.
I was involved here down in the Triangle when I was down here at another company. It was every day. Now we were having this was sort of a project correction activity. We had deployed a project to customers. We'd done the wrong things. It was lower quality. So we had bugs, you know, sort of catastrophic bugs or features that were desperately needed by customers and weren't there. And this VP put the entire, I think there was like 100 people in the department, and he put everyone, all the managers, so it wasn't the people per se, but the managers would get in a room every afternoon for 2 hours, and we would review status. We would spend about an hour preparing for that. We would spend an hour, like, sort of just exhausted after that. And literally. So every leader, and then he'd be looking for, and then we'd have actions per leader. Well, what he just did was what? He half the time on a daily basis of the stuff that we could do of helping our teams.
Right.
By just feeding him. Same principle as you on an interval. I voted with my feet at that place. I walked. I said, I'm not going to represent that. We had forced overtime. We had forced weekends. So we were doing every weekend. It wasn't forced. It was insidiously forced overtime. What he tried to do is he counted cars every morning as a in the parking lot as a measure of the team's commitment. he was a car counter. I should bring that. These are real stories, man. How do we get people to work the weekend? He wanted to buy everyone food. So his shtick was, let's send a spreadsheet around with everyone's name on it for Saturday and Sunday, and I want to buy you food. So please put your name. Please put your name there so I can feed you well.
Yeah.
And then people were ostracized. The folks that did not work on the weekends were ostracized and fired in some cases. Right?
Now, was he there on the weekends when they were working?
No, he was not there on the weekends. No. He was. He exactly, Josh.
Yeah.
Right. You know, he only counted the car during his comfortable working.
During his 9-to-5, Monday through Wednesday.
I mean, he would put in some extra time, but you get the drift of the thing. This was the team, and this was forced. What he was looking, the pizza shtick was a trick. He would measure read the Riot Act to every manager on the ratio of your people who were there per day. So he was putting that level of pressure, and he would not get out there and say that himself. So absolutely a lack of courage, right? He wouldn't do it himself. He was leveraging his quote-unquote managers to do that for him. But the same principle that you're talking about is this micromanagement to get things done. And the reason I left, it wasn't working. So, one, I didn't like the style. Two, I did not want to represent that in my management style. I found it just horrible. It was just unacceptable. But really, let's say it was acceptable. It was ineffective.
Yeah,
we were not solving problems, and that company actually did not. And I'm not putting all of the weight on his shoulders, but that company declined. In fact, that division was actually eventually sold. It was micro, sort of many layoffs. It was sort of micro sized and then sold to a competitor or something like that.
So speaking of that, it really is amazing the number of places where all these patterns happen, and somehow companies turn a profit. You know, is it just sheer will? Is it people somehow find a way to get it done because they're good people in the end, and the team delivers? I struggle with that. Like, how is this company successful?
I think it's a different question, and I didn't know where you were going, so I don't know if my brain's like ready for this, but I don't know. I think you're barely successful. I think you're so I think you can.
Yeah. So you aren't like crumbling and out of money the next week.
Right. But you're not being who you could be.
Right.
What I've seen. So a counterpoint, trying to communicate where my head is at is, I don't think you're activating your teams. So a counterpoint to me is, I've worked with teams who are doing more than I thought that they're doing. They may not be supermen or superwomen, but they're doing more than on the surface I would think they're capable of.
Right.
They're delivering more. They're truly delighting customers. Yeah. They're truly hitting the mark. They're truly getting software out there with very low defects, etc. And in those cases, those companies are doing incredibly well.
Right.
right?
Right.
And they're not just making ends meet. And I think those traditional companies, yes, they would have growth curves or revenue curves, and it would be historical, but they weren't.
They aren't accelerating.
They're not accelerating. The other thing is, I don't think you get creativity or, you know, innovation from companies like you're not generating innovation. So that's the other thing.
No, you don't let them. You don't let it. Yeah, it's not in the project plan.
So there's a nice transition for us, Josh, is innovation and creativity. Do pointy-headed managers foster an environment where they value that? Where does innovation and creativity come from in those environments?
About the only place it comes from is if you're lucky and the person coming up with the project plan has an idea and they put it in there themselves. But as far as the people that really have the tremendous ideas of how we can do something 50% faster or 100% faster or deliver higher quality or anything like that, there's no opportunity for that to be discovered by the team at all, because it is so command and control, and it is, I've got to keep each and every person fully busy for 40 hours, and if they find an extra hour, I've got something stacked up and ready for them to pick up.
Right. So I don't think they're mining. And you know what? This comes back to how were those companies successful? I think there might be, and I think you nailed another point that we didn't make, is there are good people out there who are pretty good in those environments. So let's say there's just an incredibly bright and capable project manager or development manager who has some really good technical ideas themselves, or an architect, and they can activate that.
Right.
So they're unique in the company. And by the sheer force of their will, they can present ideas, and then it's just, you know, get out of the way, and then the command and control folks drive execution.
Right.
I think that's where it comes from, but that's not sustainable. There's not that many of them. They leave, they burn out, it's a non-sustainable. So I think you see that where, you know, where's the burst in those companies like HP? I'm sure in the early days of HP, maybe that's a bad example, but there were the founders, right? And there was that burst of HP, but then you lose that. Apple's to me is an example of a sustained innovation company.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a sustainable innovation versus, I think, bursty innovation. I think command can control. So you're either status quo or declining. And occasionally someone will come in who'll make a difference, you know, in your environment.
Yeah.
And then it's just simple execution, but it's not sustainable. And I would argue it's not the best. I mean, to me, the best innovation comes from crowds, not from individuals.
Yeah, and just by sheer numbers of the likelihood of
exactly, of
a good idea coming from a group of 100 versus a group of 2,
yeah.
You know, you're going to hit something there.
Exactly. What else can we pick on about pointy-headed managers? How about reviews? How about you know, judging people, reviews, performance, how about carrots and sticks?
Right. So, I mean, one of the things to me that is very frustrating is when you don't hear anything until it's review day. You get zero feedback until review day.
Nail it, buddy. Yeah.
And it's like, well, wait a minute. So I've been doing this the whole year and you didn't say anything? You know, you couldn't
pull up a chair.
Yeah. It was too hard to say, hey, you know, buddy, just... I saw this, and what's going on?
But they jotted it down. But Josh, they jotted it down. They kept it warm.
Yeah.
For the end of the year. You're right, feedback. What's up with that? What do you think the basic root? Is it laziness? Is it too busy? Disengagement? What is that?
So I think those are all excuses, quite honestly. I think the real answer is the inability to be honest and say, you know what, here's what's wrong, because it can be a difficult discussion, right? It can be. But it's even more difficult when you do it once a year. It's a lot easier to have that discussion when you just notice it and you say, hey, can I talk to you? And ask, right? Just like we said yesterday, one of the key things that an agile manager has to do is ask questions, right?
Yep.
So I always attack it from that of, I saw this, I don't understand. Doesn't seem to make sense to me. Can you understand what your thought process was? Because I don't see how it fits with what we're trying to do. As opposed to on April 12th or whatever an annual review for your company might be is, and they say, you know what? You haven't done this well, and you haven't done it well for about 10 months. You know, and it's a lot harder to deliver that at that moment, and it's a lot harder to receive it, which makes it harder to deliver because you have this anticipated reaction of just frustration and anger, and part of that frustration and anger isn't because of the issue, it's because you're springing it on them. You know?
So let me even get it worse.
It gets worse.
It's even worse than that. So I would argue that at least you heard it.
Oh.
So let me try to really quickly tell one of my favorite stories about this. So there was a guy, long ago, I worked with Peter, and Peter was, he went to Carnegie Mellon, and he was a bright young whippersnapper software engineer out of Carnegie Mellon. Good mm-hmm. school, good computer yeah. science school. And he joined our company in our operations group, or our tech support, field support group, that was putting systems together for, this is at the trading systems company. And he worked over there for a number of years under an IBM, an ex-IBMer, 30 years. We had a few key critical IBMers. And Jim, the IBMer, was the manager of the entire op space. So he indirectly, Peter indirectly reported to him through a manager. But Jim was sort of guiding him as a mentor, too. They were going to fire Peter. So the party line was Peter was all over the place. He was uncontrolled. He did not contribute. This was, we talked about this in hallways, in boardrooms, in not during board, but in meeting rooms. It was self-evident that Peter was, you know, not meeting performance characteristics. He was there for a couple years. I called myself the island of lost toys or misfit toys at the time because I liked taking people and I liked giving them feedback, and I like trying to create high-performance teams. And it wasn't big-headedness, but mm-hmm. I could give people feedback. So they transferred Peter to me as a last ditch. I looked at his reviews. I looked at the feedback he had gotten previous to me. Guess what feedback he had gotten, Josh?
None.
Squat. Annual or not. In fact, his last review, and this is from Jim, and I told Jim later, I said, dude, you better go back to IBM management school because you weren't paying attention for the feedback. So he got, not only did he get none, he got positive feedback.
Oh, yeah.
He got a raise. He got a juicy raise. He got a promise for a promotion the next year, and he got positive feedback in his written review. But the party line was he was a moron, he couldn't handle the job, and he was all over the place. He was bright. He was incredibly, he was, people saw promise, but he flittered all over the place. What do you think I did with Peter when I transferred him into my group?
Fired him.
Yes, immediately, because he was too great of a misfit toy for me. No, but
guessing you sat him down and
I actually did something even worse than I put him on an immediate performance improvement plan.
Okay,
believe it or not, and I gave him the feedback that I had heard that he should have received.
Yeah.
Right, and then he cried basically, and he went home. He was incredibly, because what had he been told?
What? He'd been lied to. Right.
This is pointy-headed traditional managers. If you're listening out there, I'm talking to you. Don't do, you know, you basically suck. Don't do this kind of stuff. He came back after 3 days. I gave him some space because this was he actually thought, so it's even worse. Let me, the byline, he was going from ops to what? I was the director of software engineering. How do you think he's like, I'm in the big leagues now, right? So he came into my office and he's like, oh my God, I'm going to get a chance to code on the product line. This is so cool. I'm like, Peter, just calm down and sit down for a second.
Right.
Put him on a pip. He went home. He came back. Long story short, what do you think happened? Peter sucked because Jim was right.
No.
He
took the feedback, did something with it, and corrected it.
He became probably one of my top, not probably, he became, I don't know what the number is, he became in the top 20% of our engineers. He became an incredibly bright, capable engineer. The point of the story is feedback rocks.
Right.
Give it to him. Have the damn courage to do it, right? So I think that's worse than your scenario. So, and I'm not competing with you, but
no,
so getting it at the end of the year, I'll take, is that bad? Yeah, that's terrible. Blowing smoke up someone's patoot for 2.5 years, and when you know better, what is that? I don't even know what the root cause of that is. How do you go home at night and sleep?
You nailed it. It's lack of courage and just being unable to be honest with somebody because it is likely to be an uncomfortable discussion.
Yeah.
And it's just doing a disservice to the project, to your employee, to yourself, to everybody involved, right? There's just nothing good about it at all.
Those people need to be canned. I mean, I literally never looked at Jim the same way again. I confronted him about it. There was nothing really I could organizationally. There wasn't anything I could do. If I could have, I would have put him on a performance improvement plan. If I could have done that, if he would have reported to me, he would have been on a PIP for that.
Yeah.
There wasn't much I could do. But the other thing that I think, I use that example in a class I teach on leadership. And so how many of those in the management arena out there, how many gyms do you think are out there? like percentages, plus or minus 10%. I have a mental image. So how many people, so who's getting, what is the percentage of managers who are good ones versus ones who are blowing smoke?
Good ones, I'd say 30%.
Yeah. I'm even.
You're lower?
I'm thinking five.
Yeah.
I'm thinking 5 to 10. And I don't have any data, but I'm thinking the community of, how I base this is that even folks in my career, managers, you know, the smokers, the blow smokers, the lack of courageous folks, the folks who are giving partial feedback but not giving, who aren't being honest. I don't know. There's a lot of unhonest,
right.
Or unhonest, that's not a word.
We know what you mean.
Dishonest. There's a lot of dishonest conversations going on in the world, I think.
Yeah, and it's like we talked about in one of our discussions in past Medicasts about hiring, and one of the dysfunctions that we've seen is hiring yourself. So I think people promote themselves.
Perfect.
You know, so it ends up
perfect.
Again.
You hit it, man. Perfect point.
It's the water today.
It is the water. No, it's. I think it's this perpetuation of this insane. You're right. And you honor that. Yeah, you know, the best BSer gets the promotion.
Yep.
Right? Medicasters, if you could see my face now, I'm just in amazement. But it's a reality. And you know what? Agile is helping, but these folks are out there. I think it's one of those core reasons why Agile adoption is tough. It's one of the core reasons why the Agilists, quite frankly, pick on managers, don't they?
Yep.
There's a reason. I think we're hitting some of the reasons they pick. They're sort of mercilessly looking to get managers out of the equation.
Yep.
And I think we're hitting on some of those reasons. Questions. I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do questions matter? So, and we've talked about asking questions, and I think questions are incredibly powerful. We were talking about this yesterday, and I also think they can be misused. So let me give you a silly example of misuse.
Okay.
You're a project. I'm a project manager. Okay. I come to you five times a day. Are we done yet, Josh? 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 Now, you look on your desk, Josh, and there's a little plaque there that has the values of the company. So customer sensitivity to customer is number one. Holding to quality is number two. Professionalism is number three. Doing good software is number four. But I'm hovering. Are we done yet? Are we done yet? Are we done yet? Are you influenced? Are you holding to your values? Do the questions affect you?
Yeah, I mean that. So I have seen developers put signs up on their cube of "I'm not done yet. I'll tell you when I'm done." Just in reaction to that.
Yep.
In reaction to the project manager with the project plan in hand. Okay. It's 12:30. You had your 4 hours for this task that you started at 8:30 because I was watching. Are you done yet? Can I check it off? And you don't want a developer to have to get to that point, but it gets to the point where stop interrupting me and let me work. And if you had let me work, I likely would be done.
What about bumping it up to like a VP level? I agree with you, the project manager, but to me that might be efficiency. I'm actually alluding to a more subtle thing. Of where is your focus? So do those questions, so what I think those questions might be doing is emphasizing what is the prime directive. If the VP always says time,
right,
independent of what's on the value statement.
Yeah, well then just the iron triangle, we all know what loses, right? Quality is going to be the first thing that goes because they're not going to cut scope.
But even though we put it, it's on the plaque, Josh. It's on the plaque.
There are many things on many plaques that are discarded quickly when the almighty dollar is viewed in somebody's head of, if we don't deliver X, regardless of quality, regardless of maintainability, supportability, sustainability, we're going to crumble.
So what should they be asking in those questions then in order to, should they be plaque aligned, do you think, or... What questions do you ask?
Well,
what are healthy questions?
I would think just for the fact that you invested the money in the plaques, you should at least ask those questions, you know, just to get your return on those plaques. But in all seriousness, yeah, you should, you know, you should be asking about quality and asking about how are we going to maintain this? How is this going to be supportable? How is our field going to be able to install support, blah, blah, blah? How are we going to do those things? Those are the questions that you would hope and expect someone at that level is driving.
But that's that. You just nailed it. Those are, to me, those are much more powerful questions, and they, because I actually think that people get time. The team gets time. They get the time. Do we have to remind them? No, we're beating the dog to death.
Right.
I used to remind myself at a previous company that for every time I opened my mouth and asked a time-based question, like, are we done yet? And I did, because I couldn't help myself sometimes. But for every one of those, I said, Galen, I talked myself in the mirror, and I'm like, now you have 9 quality questions that you have to ask. Because what you've done is you've degraded the message to the team, the subliminal message of what's truly important.
Right.
I hope. And this isn't lip service, Metacasters. This is the truth. And I would then try to remind myself to focus on quality-oriented questions. And that's not just testing questions. That's inspection questions. That's did we write a unit test? Did we invest in a framework? Did we refactor appropriately? Right. I would remind myself. And it the effect that it had is it communicated the balance to the team. And the time factor, I found that the team got.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They read the monthly reports from executives. They looked at the people look at the stocks.
Right.
They have options. They have stock ownership, right? They read the indicators. If you're at Apple, you see Steve Jobs talking to the market. You know if you're up or down. They get, you know, you don't have to remind folks it's about getting something out the door. What you need to remind folks about is getting the right stuff out the door. I think questions are incredibly, you know, it's how you ask them and it's what you ask. And I think it's the same. I got the point across. They get it. So it's the balance.
Right.
What else? What else can we pick
on?
So
I think our last one is going to be kind of the biggest fear as a middle manager is that time when your CEO is on an airplane and he reads that magazine
front
pocket.
Yeah.
And he comes back and says, by golly, we're doing this.
Or he sits worse yet. He sits beside a pointy-headed consultant who talks to him about Agile or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a difficult situation to manage, and maybe it's good. It could be good because maybe you now have that upper-level support, that executive sponsor of Agile, so maybe you can spin it in a good way to really drive the adoption, but it can be very dangerous when executives are willing to jump in to something that they really don't understand, and now it's your problem.
Can I spin that a little bit from the point of view of maybe a big problem too is the lack of courage in middle management? We're trying to CYA too much,
mm-hmm.
and I actually think so. So it's okay for the CEO to bring that back, but if you have a willy-nilly cover my butt, I'm only here for the ride, right? I'm going to kiss up to you,
right.
Middle manager, high level manager. So someone who doesn't tell truth,
right?
Well, then that's dangerous, right? Because that stuff's going to flow right into the team,
right?
Right. But if they have some, so maybe what I'm twisting is a lot of these pointy-headed managers, they have those attributes. I would argue there is no courage; they've lost themselves,
right?
I think good managers have to be willing to walk, if you will, or have the self-confidence, you know, I can get a job elsewhere. I'm not trying to say, you know, employment is trivial.
Right.
But you have to have values. You have to have gumption. You have to be willing to say, so, no.
Right.
Right. No. I just crafted an email last night that basically is saying no to leadership.
Right.
And I think that's the. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean that's same courage thing of if you can't tell one of your employees what they're doing wrong, how are you going to turn around and upstream say, you know what,
exactly,
this isn't the right thing for us to do,
exactly.
And I look at that as that's why you hired me. You hired me to give you the right answer, whether it's the one you want to hear or maybe it is the one you don't want to hear, frustrations happen when they say, you know what, that's not what I wanted to hear. I'm like, but that's what you're paying me to do. You know, you are paying me to give you the right answers, and you might not like them all the time, but I'm telling you the truth here. You know, so being able to upstream and downstream share the truth.
I think we nailed one. I think we nailed an important one there. Is that courage? And I like to use the word courage.
Right.
I know I get pushback a lot of times, folks. Don't like that term, but it's courage. I think in our industry, and maybe this is wrapping up the Metacast, in the defense of the pointy-headed manager a little bit, I think that the complexity of the technology makes some of this stuff hard. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if the CEO comes down, well, they can negotiate with us, oh, various aspects of agility in these domains, their success stories. It's not so much like take a red pill or a blue pill.
Right.
Right. That we can defend against. But there's all these shades of gray
right.
around technology and solving problems, solving really hard problems. And I think we let the complexity get in our way mm-hmm. a lot of times instead of just really keeping our brains simple and looking at things very simplified. I like the agile aspect of that.
Right.
And it does boil down to courage. And when we don't have courage, we actually turn into problem solving. So we dive into the problem as a way of hiding.
Yeah.
Almost as a way of hiding from going to the true north
right.
of where you need to be. Did we cover it?
I think we did.
I like this Metacast. I hope the Metacasters liked it. I really enjoyed picking on some of the managers, and these were true stories. Didn't make them up. And I would argue, even though they're historical, that this stuff is happening every day nowadays. And we just need to go out there and challenge these guys. Now, I think the agile purists who want to fire them, that's the wrong approach. I think we need to challenge them.
Correct.
We need to tell truth. We need to start. I had a meeting at my job a couple weeks ago, and I was talking to a leadership team, and basically the talk, and I was trying to rally us, and I said, I don't think we're telling truth enough, and we're having the courage to tell truth enough. And I wasn't implying that we were lying. But truth is hard, and that's what I would really wrap up this Metacast with, is I think we need to just continue to challenge ourselves to tell truth. That's transparency.
Yep.
Right. It's just, it is what it is.
Yep.
And then take that truth and then move forward from the truth. Try not to avoid it. So.
From beautiful where?
Downtown Cary, North Carolina. Very early in the morning. But after a heart pump in Metacast, this is Bob Galen.
And Josh Anderson.
Shake.
And bake.
Y'all have a great day.